Hey y'all, are you looking for Glorilla? Some chocolate superfood with organic vanilla. Food-based vitamins keep you a healthy fella. Use your wife's credit card, don't even have to tell her. Go to Natural News Store, that's what it's there for. Get your superfoods, herbs, and a lot more. Feel young like you did before, and let Mother Nature's medicine work it like it's there for. I know you care for your health, therefore, don't eat those GMOs, throw them out the back door. Don't stay poor with the diet if it's killing you. Enjoy your life with nutrition that's filling you. We got freeze-dried fruit that's organic, super clean, superfoods, best on the planet. Blueberry, strawberry, even pomegranate. Yeah, it's ready to ship, and if you buy it, you can have it. Yeah, this is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. Check out store.naturalnews.com for all your organic supplements and superfoods. Or call 888-959-6415. That's 888-959-6415 to order now. Coconut, maca, spirulina, goji berry, superfood protein.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files anytime you want to listen on your phone, mobile devices, or personal computer. When you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created WebSeed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery, and our Surthrival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WebSeed.com.
Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency. For we must be the masters of our destiny. Let freedom ring.
Welcome. You're listening to the Know Your Rights Hour with Dr. Mayor Eisenstein, vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, coming to you live Monday evenings on blogtalkradio.com at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central, 7 Mountain, and 6 Pacific times. Proudly rebroadcast at naturalnewsradio.com at 1 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Central, 11 a.m. Mountain, and 10 a.m. Pacific times. We welcome your calls during the live show. It's area code 646-478-0772. That number again is area code 646-478-0772. You are welcome to call in just to listen to the show by phone or call in with your questions or comments. And you can email us during the week. The email addresses are mayor, M-A-Y-E-R, at homefirst.com, mayor at homefirst.com, and attorney at vaccinerights.com, attorney at vaccinerights.com. This is September 22nd, 2014. I'm vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, and I regret to inform you that my wonderful, wonderful co-host, Dr. Mayor Eisenstein, is not able to be with us this evening. He will be back next week at our regularly scheduled time. We have plenty to talk about tonight, so I promise not to disappoint you there, but we'll get Dr. Eisenstein back next week. I wanted to let people know I do another radio show on Tuesday evenings. It's also here on Blog Talk Radio. It is at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, 6 Mountain, and 5 Pacific times. And we will have an interesting discussion tomorrow. We always on that show have someone talking about an adverse events story, some kind of expert talking about vaccine science, and we've got a terrific expert tomorrow evening talking about the Ebola situation, Dr. Lynn Horowitz, who has researched and written about the original Ebola outbreak many years ago, talking about Ebola past and present tomorrow on the Vaccine Agenda radio show. So if you're able to tune into that, tune in. It's at blogtalkradio.com/thevaccineagenda. And I wanted to talk this evening, gosh, there's always so much more to talk about than there is time to talk about it. I wanted to let you know a little bit about some of the articles currently posted at the Pandemic Response Project website. The Pandemic Response Project is a project that I initiated back in 2009 and 10 during the so-called swine flu pandemic, when people called in from all over the country and said, hey, if they mandate this swine flu vaccine, how do I legally avoid it? And that was the first time I had dealt with emergency situations. And I learned very quickly that there are laws around the country, in states around the country, that if somebody mandates an emergency vaccine, if somebody declares an emergency, the governor orders an emergency vaccine, in most states you don't have an exemption right. What you might have is a religious or, in some states, philosophical exemption that's available, for example, for school enrollment, is not something that will apply to an emergency situation. The only state I know of where there is an exception to that is Minnesota. So folks in Minnesota, assuming the law hasn't changed there recently, do have an exemption right during a declared emergency. But as far as I know at this point in the rest of the country, you don't have that right. So we should be very concerned about that, because if you are concerned about routine vaccines, you should be and probably are even more concerned about emergency vaccines, because they rush them through production. They do what they call fast track those vaccines. So they go through even less safety studies, trials, and so forth. So we know less about the safety and effectiveness of fast track emergency vaccines than we do about routine immunizations. And I tell you, we have a pretty bad track record with the routine immunizations. So we saw lots of problems with swine flu vaccines back in 2009 and 10, and in the many months following that, as more and more adverse event stories came forward and adverse events problems documented. So I created the Pandemic Response Project as a project with a long-term goal, changing state laws around the country to allow exemption rights during declared emergencies. So if anyone listening is interested in working on that project or any vaccine-related legislative project in your state, and if you'd like my help with that, I would be glad to help you. That's a big part of what I do from time to time, is I work with legislative activists around the country to help them put together the convincing medical and legal arguments, in particular in support of or opposition to any particular piece of vaccine-related legislation. It just depends on whether the particular piece of legislation is something that's going to try to further the right to make informed choices, or something that's furthering the vaccine agenda, as to whether it's something that we would support or oppose. But I'm available to help with that. Well, just real briefly, the Pandemic Response Project website, and that the URL is all of these words spelled out and run together, no spaces or dashes or anything like that, pandemicresponseproject.com, pandemicresponseproject.com. And then there are a row of primary links at the top of each page, and on the upper right-hand corner is a link to the news page. So I update this page daily or almost daily And lately, there have just been so many news articles coming out. And I don't post every news article about vaccines that comes out, but if it's something that's related to law or politics or otherwise stands out to me as critically important, if it comes my way, I'll post a link to it. So I don't want to spend time this evening talking about these articles, but I wanted to just read a few of the titles to give you an idea of some of the things that are going on in the vaccine arena generally, and what kinds of articles are posted at the Pandemic Response Project website generally. So, for example, here's a very recent article, just the last couple of days, from Belgium. GlaxoSmithKline accidentally releases 11 gallons of live polio virus into city's water supply. How do you accidentally release 11 gallons of live polio virus into the city's water supply? Now, of course, they're immediately claiming, hey, no problem, no big deal, don't worry about it, nobody's going to be hurt by that. Well, it's not like I expect them to say, run for your lives, you know, don't touch the water and don't come back for 50 years, but that's just a real tough one to swallow. Another article, the title is, Why is China Having Measles Outbreaks When 99% Are Vaccinated? China apparently has a very aggressive vaccination program. They have a 99% vaccination rate, but they're having measles outbreaks all over the place. Tells you something about the effectiveness of the vaccine, doesn't it? Or should I be a little more precise and say lack of effectiveness? Another article here that says the CDC owns the patent on the Ebola virus and that agency to collect royalties on all future Ebola vaccines. An article from Natural News. Well, I mean, there's always money involved, isn't there? Let's see, what else have we got here? An article from, this is actually a YouTube video from the Alex Jones channel on YouTube. Obama invades Africa under Ebola smokescreen. The idea there being, now they're sending troops to Africa, which I have to admit is a little confusing to me. What are you sending troops for, supposedly to help with Ebola? Shouldn't you be sending medical people? And I'm sure they're doing that too. I can't imagine they wouldn't also be doing that. But why are they sending troops? Well, I think the theory, according to this YouTube on Alex Jones, is that the Ebola crisis is a false pretense that's going to basically allow for the U.S. to invade Africa for other agendas. And to learn more about that, go to the link to that YouTube video from the Pandemic Response Project. Another article from the Huffington Post. First volunteer receives potential Ebola vaccine in safety trial. Now, we had information a month ago that said they were already developing Ebola vaccines. Some information to suggest that these have been at least preliminary stages in development many, many years ago, 10 years ago, that this isn't something they just sort of threw together earlier this year after we started having these Ebola outbreaks in Africa. But I had read an article saying that pharmaceutical companies were reluctant to spend any time and money developing an Ebola vaccine because there wasn't any money in it. There wasn't a market for it. Well, they brought a couple of people back from Africa to the U.S. who supposedly had Ebola. That then was on the news all over the country, mainstream news, and everybody talking about it, whether they should or shouldn't have done it, and so forth. So everybody's aware of Ebola. The many people in the mainstream circles are all but predicting, if not predicting, Ebola outbreaks here in the U.S. And so just the awareness and fear factor there already has at least primed the pump for an Ebola vaccine market here. And I'm sure if they need it to sell vaccines, somebody will create an Ebola outbreak, whether it really exists or not. And I say that partly being cynical, but also, I mean, look what happened with the swine flu vaccine. There never was a pandemic level 6. that's the highest level that the World Health Organization have. There's six different levels of seriousness of pandemics, and they declared the swine flu pandemic a level six, and they redefined level six so that a very mild disease could get that level six designation. And upon getting that designation, it triggered contract clauses with the pharmaceutical industry and countries around the world for what ended up being the sale of $18 billion in swine flu vaccines. Now, the swine flu itself was far less virulent than the seasonal flu, which has never been declared a pandemic. But they declared the swine flu a level 6 pandemic. And they redefined level 6 over the objection of many countries. The World Health Organization redefined it anyway, and that was so they could sell billions of dollars of vaccines, most of which, by the way, were never administered. So that was quite a fiasco, and even the British Medical Journal, one of the world's most prestigious medical journals, criticized the World Health Organization for its mishandling of this of that whole issue. But of course, nobody did anything wrong. Of course, they did their own internal investigation and everything was fine. And of course, nobody goes to jail or gets punished or loses a job or whatever. Billions of dollars are spent on vaccines that were never, most of which were never administered. But I tell you, many of the ones that were administered caused serious problems that we heard with narcolepsy in vaccine recipients, originally in Scandinavia and then later in many other countries around the world, substantial increases in narcolepsy attributed to the swine flu vaccine. Something, it was more than a 2,400% increase in fetal deaths here in the U.S. associated with the swine flu vaccine compared to the seasonal flu vaccine from the previous year. It's a very, very serious problem. So I personally do not put a lot of faith and trust in any kind of Ebola vaccine that comes out. So that's the situation there. If you have an opportunity, go to the Pandemic Response Project, pandemicresponseproject.com, to the news page. It's updated daily or almost daily with new articles, all different kinds of topics concerning medical, legal, and political aspects of vaccination, current articles. Now, the Department of Health and Human Services, and let me clarify, the federal Department of Health and Human Services, many states have a state Department of Health and Human Services as well. The federal Department of Health and Human Services has what they call their Healthy People 2020 initiative. And that initiative has specific goals, which include vaccinating 90% of the nation's healthcare workers annually with the influenza vaccine by 2020. And we've talked on this show a lot about healthcare workers and their rights. But there's a separate goal in that Healthy People 2020 initiative of vaccinating 80% of the entire U.S. adult population annually with the influenza vaccine by 2020. I want to spend this evening, take advantage of the opportunity to have the show to myself tonight, to go in depth and talk to you more about legal rights as it concerns employer-required vaccines. Right now, and in very recent years, last 3 or 4 years in particular, we've seen more and more hospitals switching from influenza vaccine recommendation to very strong recommendation to outright mandate, get the shot or lose your job. This is not something, however, that is going to stop with healthcare workers, because DHHS has a target on all of our backs. The healthcare workers are first, because they're going to hold them up as a model to the rest of the country, say, hey, look, all of your healthcare workers are vaccinated. They will, of course, conveniently omit the part about how if they didn't get vaccinated, they'd lose their jobs, and that's why they're vaccinated. And they're going to say, look, all your healthcare workers are vaccinated. You need to be vaccinated, too. We have already at least a couple, if not a few states, that have state laws mandating or requiring healthcare workers to be vaccinated. I know here in North Carolina last year, it was the health department that implemented a rule mandating that all the state healthcare workers, about 10,000 here, had to get the flu shot or lose their jobs. But I think most of the time at this point around the country, it's just the companies. It's a company policy, but this is driven by the Department of Health and Human Services, at least at one level, by their goal of vaccinating 90% of healthcare workers. But I want to talk about the employment arena this evening because this is something that affects healthcare workers increasingly, and many of them already now, but it's something that's coming for every adult in the U.S. unless we are organized enough and speak loudly enough and in a focused and coherent voice and demand that these mandates for the flu shots either don't occur at all or that if they have already occurred that they be undone. Believe it or not, the state of Oregon actually has a law prohibiting hospitals from mandating flu shots. And surprise, surprise, they probably have the nation's lowest rate of influenza vaccine among healthcare workers. You have a right to make your own decision, and it's just amazing what'll happen when you let people make their own decision. And this is, I tell you, this is so ironic, a polite word for crazy or stupid, so ironic that they are mandating a healthcare policy to healthcare workers instead of asking them, as healthcare professionals, what their opinion is. What a concept. Let's ask the healthcare professionals what their opinion is. And I'll tell you what I hear from healthcare workers all over the country. And at this point, I've worked with something on the order of maybe 325, 350 healthcare workers around the country in probably, well over half of the states. And that's only likely to increase significantly as more and more hospitals continue to get on board with mandates. But what I hear from the healthcare workers themselves, I hear things like, I never get the shot, or I haven't had a flu shot in 20 years, and I never get sick, or I've only been sick once. It's the people who get the shot who are taking time off because they get sick, either from the shot directly or sometime during the flu season. I hear both of those stories anecdotally. But we know from information that Dr. Paul King has given us in recent shows and in recent months that there are studies that support this. It's not purely anecdotal evidence, as my report is from my own work with healthcare workers. But there's research, for example, with teenagers showing that if they got a flu vaccine, they had between 3 and 4 times the rate of upper respiratory illness compared to the ones who didn't get a flu shot. And the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota reported on research showing that if you got a flu shot 2 years in a row, it could even lower your protection. And this is what, again, I'm hearing and anecdotally from all over the country in my practice. And so there it is, folks. It's spelled out in the peer-reviewed published literature. It's showing up in practice. This is crazy, crazy policy. But as of right now, the agenda is rolling forward full steam. So what do we do about this? Well, as a starting place, if you are working for an employer that has more than 15 employees, then you potentially fall under a federal civil rights law umbrella. And why do we need to look at federal civil rights law? What about the exemption laws all over the country that every state has? Well, the state exemption laws, rare exceptions here, but for the most part, the state exemption laws do not apply to employees. These are laws written for kids enrolling in school or daycare or young adults, not necessarily young, but typically young adults in college. I say not necessarily. I went back to law school in my 40s. Still consider myself a young adult at this point in time, but not in the same way that somebody 22 or 23 going to college, or 18 or 19 going to college right out of high school would be doing, or even sometimes 17, depending on how the years and months and birthdays fall. So according to the CDC, and they post this on their website, there are three states that do have state exemption laws that could apply or do apply to healthcare workers in particular. I don't know if these laws are for just healthcare workers or for any employees. But those states are Maryland, Maine, and New Hampshire. As far as I know, those are the only states that have a state exemption law that would apply to at least some employees. So folks in the rest of the country, and I hear this all the time, it's a very reasonable misunderstanding, but it is nevertheless a misunderstanding. And they'll say, well, my state has religious and philosophical exemptions, or all three exemptions, medical, religious, and philosophical, and my employer is ignoring me. Well, it's not so much that they're ignoring you, it's just that those laws don't apply to employees. They apply to students and kids in daycare, maybe college students, but not to employees. So for most U.S. employees, there is not an exemption law, a law that says here's your right to say no to vaccines in the workplace. But there is, well, first of all, there's always the right to a medical exemption in any situation. But let me tell you what I'm seeing around the country by way of my clients, what they report to me about medical exemptions in hospitals. Now, this whole situation with vaccines in the workplace and in healthcare workers in particular in recent years and months, it's all in a state of flux. It's all evolving as we go. As I mentioned earlier, the policies shift from recommendation to strong recommendation to mandate. It seems like most hospitals are moving in the same direction, but they're getting there at different times. So every year for the last 3 years, I've been contacted by healthcare workers who say they just mandated the vaccine this year. And I've already heard reports of some hospitals that will be mandating the vaccine, but not until next year. So as each year passes and we get closer and closer to 2020, I think we're going to see more and more hospitals getting on board with the mandates. And we may see that. In fact, I fully expect we will see that in many other industries. Healthcare starting there, but moving to many other industries. And we already see bills or laws in states around the country that would require, or maybe already are requiring, vaccines for daycare workers. And I think we can expect to see some mandatory vaccines in the food service industry, any place people are working with the general public. So we'll see this with teachers and schools. I mean, as I said before, we all have targets on our back. None of us are immune to this, for lack of a better word, perhaps there. We're going to see this, you know, across the board, again, if we don't take steps to stop it. So exactly where and how, we'll just have to see how it unfolds. But it's going to be increasing and rapidly and more rapidly as we get closer and closer to 2020, as more and more states, state legislatures in terms of bills and laws they're trying to pass, and then companies in the, well, public and private sector are trying to get in line with these goals for any of a variety of reasons, but because the goals are there and are stated. So what I see going on with medical exemptions is that they were pretty lenient in years past. But I see hospitals gradually, well, maybe not even so gradually, rapidly around the country moving to more and more strict medical exemption policies. For example, it looks like they're all moving towards or eventually arriving at a policy that is something very similar to this, that you cannot have a medical exemption unless you have a history, and this would have to be a documented history, documented in a medical record, something that a medical doctor is going to back you up on, history of anaphylactic shock to a vaccine or Guillain-Barré syndrome within 6 weeks of a vaccine. Now, is there a right to refuse a vaccine required for work if you don't meet that strict standard? There may be, but, and this is an area that I'm not particularly, don't have in-depth knowledge on, but I tell you, the way I'm looking at it at this point, pending more information that would give me a more precise or deeper insight into this, at the end of the day, it very likely could just be your doctor against their expert. Let's say you took one of these kind of cases to court, and there have been some nurses who have taken some of these cases to court. Haven't heard about anybody winning one yet, but I've heard of at least a couple of cases in recent weeks where they've gone to court. And your doctor is going to say, my client has or my patient has this particular condition and that makes her vulnerable to a serious adverse reaction. She shouldn't get the vaccine. And their expert's going to look at the same medical records and say, no, it's okay. This person can get a vaccine. And what's a judge going to do when you've got conflicting expert testimony? I really think it's a toss-up. And courts generally will go with public policy if there's nothing else to determine the outcome of the case, and public policy favors vaccination. So I think these medical cases are going to be hard to win. I hope somebody proves me wrong, but that's my perhaps pessimistic but honest look at this point. Well, there's a much better way to approach this, and I'm going to talk about it right after break. I had a nurse client last year. She had letters from three different medical doctors saying she should not get the vaccine for medical reasons, and the employer still said, we don't care, get the shot, or you're out of here. Lose your job. So she came to me, and I was able to help her get an exemption. I'm going to talk to you about the out. It has to do with federal civil rights law right after the break. You're listening to the Know Your Rights Hour. Normally, with vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips and my good friend Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Dr. Eisenstein, not able to be with us this evening, will be back with us next week. But we got lots to talk about on the other side of break. I'm going to come back and talk to you about how federal civil rights law works in case you are dealing either now or in the future with a vaccine mandate at work, whether it's because there's a state law passed requiring it, or the company has just decided to mandate it as company policy to get in line with the Department of Health and Human Services 2020 goals. So we'll be right back in just a little bit. Stay tuned. Lots more coming right at you after the break.
The Natural News Store is now open. Hi, this is Joni Cox with Homegrown Health with some great news for your health and your budget. Visit shopnaturalnews.com to start saving money right now on superfoods like cacao, camu camu, and acai. You'll find coconut flour, coconut sugar, and hemp seeds, as well as detox products like Zeotrex, Oxy Powder, and Nascent Iodine. You'll also find survival organic food supplies and colloidal silver. Both can help you prepare for natural disasters or other events that might threaten your health or safety. As Hurricane Sandy recently taught America, just one storm can knock out the power grid and leave us all scrambling for food and medicine. We've also got amazing herbal medicine cabinets and herbal survival kits. Plus, we're the exclusive source for the all-new Natural Attitude Turmeric Extract. It's a powerful, alcohol-free, liquid form of turmeric with high absorbability. Plus, get free shipping in the USA on orders of $99 or more. A portion of all sales helps fund health freedom and food freedom initiatives. Find all this and much more at shopnaturalnews.com. That's shopnaturalnews.com. Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files anytime you want to listen on your phone, mobile devices, or personal computer. When you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created WebSeed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery. And our Surthrival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WebSeed.com.
We are back with the Know Your Rights Hour. Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips here with you this evening. Dr. Mayor Eisenstein, unable to be with us, but he will be back with us next week. So tune back in again next week, and we'll be back to our usual delightful duo selves. I wanted to talk to you about federal civil rights law. Now, the federal civil rights law arena, for our purposes, concerns religious objections to vaccines. But I know a lot of people are going to hear that and they're going to tune out. They're going to say, I'm not a Christian Scientist, or I don't go to church, or I don't have religious objections to vaccines. I want to ask you to hold off before you do that if you're one of the people who's thinking along those lines, because the question here is not, do you have religious objections to vaccines? It is, how does the law define religion for legal purposes, and do any of your beliefs fall under that umbrella? And this is a technical distinction, but an important technical distinction, because it turns out that the way the law defines religion for religious purposes is very, very broad. And many people whose first thought is, well, I don't have religious objections to vaccines, will learn once they find out more about how the law defines religion for legal purposes that maybe they do qualify for religious exemption. So let me talk about that a little bit. The way we know what does and doesn't qualify in large part has to do with legal precedent. What have the courts said about the boundaries? But let me give you an example. I have seen a couple of doctors arguing on the internet in the past about whether or not the Bible is opposed to vaccines. And one doctor says, well, the Bible was written 2,000 years ago. Of course it's not opposed to vaccines. And which I think is kind of silly, because you could just as easily spin that both ways. Well, the Bible was written 2,000 years ago, so of course it's not for vaccines. But the point for our purposes here is that that's the wrong question. That is a theological question, and there's nothing wrong inherently with theological questions. People have been asking them for years. There have been debates and arguments and discussions, and they'll go on forever, I'm sure, and that's all fine. That's all well and good. But we're talking about a legal right here, and so the real question is a legal question. And again, what I said a couple minutes ago, how does the law define religion for legal purposes? And the short answer with respect to the Bible debate there is that both of those beliefs are potentially protected beliefs. When we say what qualifies for religious exemption, another way of thinking of that is what beliefs are protected by law. And the starting place is really very, very simple. It gets complicated, but the starting place is simple, and that is that you only have to meet two criteria. Your beliefs only have to be religious in nature and sincerely held. If your beliefs are religious in nature and sincerely held, they are protected beliefs. So your belief could be protected whether or not you think the Bible is opposed to vaccines. Now, obviously, only one of those is going to qualify you for an exemption, because only one of them is opposed to vaccines. But neither one is ultimately correct for legal purposes. They can both be correct for legal purposes in the sense of are they protected beliefs? And when we say protected here, first and foremost, what we're talking about is the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The First Amendment has, among other things, this free exercise clause, as it's referred to, and the free exercise clause refers to the free exercise of religion. Well, what does that mean exactly? Because the Constitution doesn't say anything about vaccines. Well, we have to look to the courts, to legal precedent, and the courts help define the lines, the details. So a full explanation of that is quite lengthy, but in brief, just a real quick overview of that, it doesn't matter whether you belong to any religious organization at all. It doesn't matter which one you belong to if you do belong to one. In fact, you could literally be the only person on the planet with your specific religious beliefs, and if they are religious in nature and sincerely held, they are protected beliefs. Now, there are a number of legal pitfalls when it comes to how do you write a legally sound statement of religious beliefs opposed to vaccines, a number of pitfalls that people tend to fall into when they do this on their own, and that's why anytime somebody's in a situation where they have to state their beliefs to get a religious exemption to vaccines, sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. It just depends on the applicable law and the situation. But anytime you do need to state your beliefs, that's when I recommend people do a consultation so they can nail down a legally sound statement of beliefs. Because most people, in my experience, will shoot themselves in the foot. It's not because of anybody's lack of intelligence or anything like that. It's just because the way the law works on this specific point is not consistent with most people's common sense approach to it. Sometimes the law does exactly what we would expect it to do or think it would do or should do, but not always. And this is one of those arenas where there are several what I call legal pitfalls. I tell you, the single biggest one I see, not the only one by any means, but the single biggest one is where people mix in concerns about adverse events. If you can't afford a consultation and you got to state your beliefs and somebody's going to be looking at it, don't talk about vaccine adverse events. That's considered a medical issue, not a legal religious issue for legal purposes, not a religious issue. So stay away from that. But let me go back to the federal civil rights law. We got a few minutes left here, and I wanted to tell you a little bit more about how the federal civil rights law works. The Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964, and the part of that act that's called Title VII, that's Roman numeral VII, VII, Title VII makes it unlawful for employers to discriminate against employees on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. With respect to religion, employers, if they have, I forget if it's 15 or more or over 15, but 15 is the cutoff, 15 employees. So this does not apply to little mom and pop shops, but hospitals, big business, absolutely. And public or private, doesn't matter whether it's a public company or private company, this law applies to them. And it doesn't matter if the flu shot is required by state law or just by company policy. Title VII and federal civil rights law provides a potential out on religious grounds. So, you know what? Let me say here. Title VII says that employers have to reasonably accommodate their employees' religious beliefs and practices. This is not a vaccine religious exemption law. This is a religious accommodation law. But it can function purposes like an exemption law. But it's much more broad than that. Anything that has to do with your religious beliefs or practices that's a conflict with you and your employer, you can potentially seek religious accommodation. And there are many parts and pieces to this. I'm trying to give you the most I could give you this evening on radio is an introduction. But this law provides an out on religious grounds. Now, I already said it doesn't matter whether you belong to any church at all, doesn't matter which one you belong to if you do. I want to take that one step further because federal civil rights law is really interesting in the language. There is an EEOC compliance manual. The EEOC is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. That's the federal agency that enforces Title VII and some other anti-discrimination laws. The compliance manual spells out what beliefs are protected by federal civil rights law. So, for example, there is language that refers to the obvious. Federal civil rights law protects theistic beliefs, beliefs that include a belief in God, but also, now this is a long sentence here, so hang there in here with me on this, but also non-theistic, which I think would include atheistic, also non-theistic moral or ethical beliefs as to what is right and wrong, which are sincerely held with the strength of traditional religious views, ultimate ideas about life, purpose, and death. That's a long sentence. Let me read that to you again. Non-theistic moral or ethical beliefs as to what is right and wrong, which are sincerely held with the strength of traditional religious views, ultimate ideas about life, purpose, and death. And all I want to say about that for right now is that this is so incredibly broad. On the one hand, it's very specific. But at the same time, it is just amazingly broad. You could even be an atheist and have protected religious beliefs. You know, that's one way of thinking about this. Now, the specific beliefs, you know, have to be ones that qualify. So again, based on what I see in my practice, is that most people have difficulty when they do this on their own. They wander into one or more of these so-called legal pitfalls. But as a starting place, just about anybody can potentially qualify for a religious exemption. Like I have people say to me all the time, I'm not religious, but I'm very spiritual. Well, for legal purposes, all the same thing. It's all religious. Don't even necessarily have to believe in God. It can still potentially have qualifying religious belief. So it's really, really broad. You just have to make sure you approach it the right way. Well, what is the deal? Are hospitals or employers, are they required to offer religious exemption? Not under Title VII. But most of them do. I've seen a small number of hospitals that say we don't offer a religious exemption. Most of them do. But sadly, what I see in well over 95% of the time, I haven't kept exact count, but I would guess it's over 95% of the time of the somewhere in the vicinity now of 325 healthcare workers that I've worked with around the country, hospitals implement unlawful policies. They create all these requirements for a religious exemption that federal civil rights law does not allow them to do. They require things like a letter from a member of the clergy. Well, you don't even have to be a member of an organized religion to qualify for religious accommodation. They want you to sign a document that says you agree you're putting everyone at risk and causing all these problems by not getting a vaccine, et cetera, et cetera. I won't go into the full explanation, but that violates your free speech rights under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The free speech, it turns out, not only is your right to have and share your opinion, but also your right to be free from being compelled to speak, which being required to agree with somebody else is. Now, details of this I'll leave out for the moment in the interest of time here, but that's another issue that comes up here. Often, the people who don't get a vaccine have to get a bright yellow dot on their name tag, or maybe it's the other way around. Everybody who gets their vaccine gets their little, you know, dot on their name badge. They can't single you out because of your religious beliefs like that. Discriminatory. Mask policies. Mask policies are truly bizarre. I've had at least three different nurses tell me that they were told if they didn't get a vaccine, they're going to have to wear a mask for all 12 hours of their shift for 8 months out of the year. I mean, come on, seriously? That's ridiculous. Let me give you the short story on mask policies. And this is one that probably would apply to healthcare workers. I'd be surprised if we started seeing non-healthcare employers requiring masks, but we may. They may try to do that. These policies are mostly punitive. You know, how dare you ruin our 100% vaccine compliance rate by not getting a vaccine and exercising your right to say no, we're going to punish you for that. So they implement these really bizarre mask policies. They're coercive, they're punitive. They're just punishing people or trying to talk them out of wearing the mask. Well, here's my take on the mask policy. You know what the CDC says about masks? Now, I disagree with the CDC on just about anything having to do with vaccines, but I think their mask policy is first rate. They're not always bad or wrong. They got it right on the money. The CDC has said in a formal legal publication that the proper mask policy for healthcare workers is that you wear a mask when you or the patient have symptoms and you are in close proximity to one another. This is a very sensible, kind of common sense thing. The CDC points out that face masks do not filter or block viruses out of the air. So their policy doesn't have anything to do with your vaccination status. It has everything to do with your symptom status. And the CDC says there's no research to show that a more aggressive mask policy has any benefit. So there's no point in doing it. So when I say that under Title VII, under federal civil rights law, that the employer has to accommodate the employee's religious beliefs and practices, that accommodation has to be a reasonable accommodation. So if you're telling someone they have to wear a mask throughout the whole shift and flu season if they don't get a vaccine, that's not reasonable. There's no research to support the idea that that has any benefits. And at least according to the CDC, and aren't they the top government authority on this issue? Aren't they the ones whose vaccine policies we're following? So we ought to be following their mask policies as well. Well, that's one side of, I'm sure, a two- or multi-sided issue. There are employers that say, oh, well, we don't follow the CDC policy. We follow somebody else's recommendation. So some of these are not clear-cut issues in terms of one side or the other backing down quietly, quickly, and easily. But I find so far, anything I've heard to date, I find the CDC argument the most compelling and the most convincing one that I've heard. Well, let me go back to other parts here to the federal civil rights law. They don't necessarily have to offer religious exemption, although most hospitals, in my experience, do. Not all, but most. But if you, an employee, request religious accommodation, then that triggers their legal obligation to accommodate you. And they have to accommodate you unless they can show an undue hardship. Well, what the heck does that mean, undue hardship? Well, usually what that means is unless it's going to cost them a bunch of money to accommodate you, then they have to accommodate you. To my surprise, frankly, I've never encountered a hospital that says we don't allow religious exemptions because it's going to cause us an undue hardship. It's going to be too much risk to patients and staff and visitors or whatever. I've never heard anyone say that. So I'm really surprised, but that's great. I'll take it. But, you know, could it cause an undue hardship? Well, I'm not going to go into detail here, but we've talked at length in this show about many peer-reviewed published mainstream studies that say that flu vaccines don't work or very low rates of effectiveness or it can even be counterproductive. So clearly, it's not going to cause an undue hardship for a hospital to allow the occasional religious exemption. But I want to take this undue hardship argument one step further, because we're likely to see more and more vaccines be added. In fact, I've already had healthcare workers get a hold of me. They're being required to be revaccinated with the childhood vaccines, MMR, DTaP, and so forth. Hep B is a big one with hospital workers. And the CDC wants to revaccinate all adults with all these vaccines. So they're just, you know, rolling this out one step at a time. They're going as fast as they think they can get away with. There will be resistance, but not enough to actually stop them from continuing to go forward. So they're getting bolder and bolder and rolling forward with more and more mandates. The CDC says that 5 to 15% of vaccinated people don't develop immunity. You know, even as they measure immunity, the antibody production, and there's a whole separate question as to whether that really means immunity, and the shorter answer is no, it doesn't. And there's research, peer-reviewed published research, underscoring that fact. And just recently, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny was saying that on my other radio show, so I will credit her as my most recent source for this. But let's assume for the moment, we'll go with their definition that antibody production equals immunity, even though it really doesn't. By that standard, According to the CDC, 5 to 15% of vaccinated people don't develop immunity. You look at the medical literature, and for some vaccines, it's much higher than that. But let's use their conservative figures. The CDC also reports that nationally, the average number of exemptions, now this would be kids in school, but I suspect hospital exemption rates are either comparable or much lower, probably much lower. The national exemption average around the country in kids in school, under 2%. So you've got somewhere, give or take, 10% or more of vaccinated people aren't immune, less than 2% exemptions. And according to the CDC, exempt people can have natural immunity, you know, that rare condition that nobody's ever heard of anymore, natural immunity, without even developing symptoms. You don't even have to get sick in any obvious external way. You can be exposed to a disease, have what they call a subclinical infection, you don't even get sick or feel sick, and you end up having the antibodies and being immune for the rest of your life. What a concept. So here's the deal, folks. You cannot tell with any given individual whether or not they are immune or protected based on their vaccination status. Many vaccinated people are not immune. Many unvaccinated people have natural immunity. So here's the deal in hospitals, okay? If this whole flu shot deal or any other vaccine that comes along in hospitals, if the whole deal here really had anything to do with immunity and protecting staff and patients, they would have to be testing, doing titer tests, on everybody in the hospital who works with immunocompromised patients, any high-risk patients, because they'd have to find out which of those workers are not immune, which ones' vaccines didn't work. We know that some of these people's vaccines didn't work because the medical literature tells us this, and the CDC acknowledges that. But you don't know which ones unless you test them. I have never heard of a hospital that tests immunocompromised patients to find out, or not the patients, the employees who work with the immunocompromised patients or high-risk patients to find out which ones' vaccines didn't work so that they can either revaccinate them or reassign them somewhere else until flu season is over or whatever would be appropriate. Never heard of that. So I conclude it's obviously not a serious health issue. And to go back to the legal argument, therefore, not going to be an undue hardship to allow the occasional, you know, religious exemption or even, you know, some significant percentage of religious exemptions. And with the flu vaccine in particular, the best study I've seen, best in terms of what favors the vaccine best, was a study that said it was around 60% effective. And even that study was a manipulation of the data to misrepresent the facts. That 60% figure was rounded up and was what's called the relative risk reduction. The actual risk reduction in that study was only 1.5%, but of course that's not going to sound very good, so well, let's use the relative risk reduction and say that's how effective the vaccine is. But even if we assume, which is incorrect, but even if we assume that the vaccine is 60% effective, you're never going to get herd immunity theory, excuse me, you're never going to achieve herd immunity. It's only Monday and I'm already feeling like Friday. You're never going to achieve herd immunity with 60% effectiveness, even if you vaccinate every last single person. So the whole idea that you have to vaccinate most people with the flu vaccine so that everybody's protected just doesn't hold up. So therefore, again, they can handle some number of religious exemptions and won't cause them any problems. Well, that's as far as I've got time to go this evening on this. Can talk about it more another time. You're always welcome to email Mayer or myself. That's M-A-Y-E-R, mayer@homefirst.com, attorney@vaccinerights.com. And, of course, you're always welcome to call into the show during the live show if you'd like to ask questions, if you'd like to know more about how any of this works. But let me see now. I'm going to have to start the exit music and do my little talk out here. Thanks so much for being with us this evening, folks. Dr. Mayer Eisenstein will be back with me next week. We'll be our usual delightful duo. You've been listening to the Know Your Rights Hour with Dr. Mayer Eisenstein, usually with me, not tonight, and vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips. We're here every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, and rebroadcast the National News Radio Wednesday afternoons at 1 p.m. and 10 a.m. Pacific.
Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars.